C1A. Number 28A.
Last time we took that tone of love as truth and love as love in Atonement Eucharist. And I think I was so kind not to give any questions about it. So we don't have to take that text today and go over it as we did before. And that gives me a wonderful opportunity to take this afternoon and to relax a little bit. And when I say to relax a little bit, I mean let's just go over the big main tone of prayer and atonement and Eucharist without any strain. Just let's consider the import and the bigness of the main tone more and more, because it is important that we do not do just a lot of arduous study, but that we take the time and the quietude to imbibe these research works, these findings, and make them our own. And only as we make them our own until they change us and become our new nature, when we arrive at that point, then these facts of being begin to live in us spontaneously and naturally, and then we really have gained something in the line of spiritual evolution. So it isn't the drive to always find something new, which may be supermost in my thought at the present moment. It's much more the love we can give to what we already know, which I think is so important today. The world has so many claims on us today, and that it is important that we live more and more consciously, spontaneously in the spiritual universe. And so let us just relax and adore some of these fundamental points which within the last year we have made our own. Mr. Dooley always used to speak of the new old story, of the one story which was old and always new. He didn't present us every day a new story, but always the old story, perhaps in a new form, in a new symbolism, but it's the one old story. And there is no new God. There is just that one old new God. There is no new reality. There is just that one old ever new reality. And so we don't go back to something if we consider that which we already know. But we really go forward in the line of spiritual evolution if we adore and love and inwardly worship that which we already know. That gives substance to that which we have studied. And I think it's one of the most beautiful feelings I always have when I come on Saturday here. I always feel how grateful we can be that we find a couple of people who are willing, each one, to sacrifice a weekend, to sacrifice time, energy, money, and so on, to come together for a complete selfless motive, namely to worship the infinite, to lay aside so many personal ambitions and longings and wishes and desires in order to sacrifice all that on the altar of science, on the altar of research of science, investigation into science, and that's something big. And we all contribute to that in equal measure. And that's what perhaps Jesus meant when he said that two or three are gathered together in my name, I shall be there in the midst. And I believe the world needs us today more than ever. The world seems to be in such a turmoil, and the problems which are coming up today seem so intricate, so forworn. How would you say, Harold, forworn? Intricate. They are woven into each other that it is like the Gordic knot. You don't know how to solve it, really. Therefore, it's so necessary to take that time of quietude and peace of mind to think about another world, the world of reality. And when I'm here, I'm only here to share with you and you with me what we have been thinking during the last 2 months. You see, the moment we touch science, preaching and personal teaching goes out of the way. There is a big difference between preaching and interpreting. And I like to make a point out of that, because what we are doing is that we all together come together to analyze the principle of being as revealed through the text of the textbook. And in no way are we gathered together here to listen to a preaching, to a sermon. Because if one preaches something, one must at least demonstrate and live 100% what one preached. But with the textbook, nobody, I think, would feel he could do that. Because the demands of the textbook and the statements of the textbook, the propositions of the textbook, have such a high standard that no one could honestly say, well, I have lived and demonstrated this text, and I'm now going to tell the other how to do it, and how he should do it and has to do it, and preach down on him what he should do. But we are coming together to investigate a science. We have a big, firm conviction that the divine principle of being has spoken through the pages of the text. That was perhaps first a conviction. Then, little by little, as we investigated this principle and learned that this principle presents itself always more and more in a consistent way, in a principled way. The more we see that, the more this conviction or the hypothesis that principle has been speaking through the textbook becomes a clear, firm understanding of it. Today, I think, already after two first chapters of the textbook, after having seen how systematically and orderly and gently the text is built up, we are convinced and even are standing in awe before the fact that in this textbook is a coherent science. So let's therefore be clear when we come together and when we study in the meantime that we are not studying something which I have told you, and that you try to see if it is right what I have said. But our teacher is the text of the textbook, and that we always go back to the text of the textbook as the symbolization of the revealed divine principle in its science. And so every sense of personality goes out of the picture. And if you help me in doing that, you do a great favor to me, to you, and to the world, and especially an enormous favor to the development of this science. Because here and there always some sense of personal sense wants to creep in. It's in the nature of the human mind. But it's good to realize that unless we put any sense of personal teaching and preaching and personal sense at all out of the whole thing, unless we do that, the science cannot harmoniously, orderly unfold. There will be some sort of friction. So in investigating this one science, we can see what our attitude must be. It must be first to seek the science, not to seek what I have said, to seek the science. And as we seek the science, for what? For finding the laws and the rules and the order regulating the science, we begin to find them. We have found in the first two chapters some very wonderful order, you remember? The order how the first chapter is built up in the word order, how the second chapter is built up in the word order, so clear now. But we also saw how the first chapter then leads to the second chapter, how the second chapter couldn't come before the first chapter. And so we'll see tomorrow how it pushes on to the third chapter, and we see the order of the four coming into birth. And so we begin to see that everything, every factor in this science just links with each other factor into one web of consistency, without seam or rent, into oneness of being, into one science. And the beauty of it is that each one of us can be the discoverer, can find, and the measure we find it, it is up to each one how much of it he's going to use. Then it's no more a question of a preacher preaching down to somebody. Each one then, in the measure as he begins, finds the laws regulating being he's spoken to, so to say, by the divine, and asks, how much are you going to live up to it? And we know so well that we can only live up to it in a measure, and not yet in the fullest sense. That this is the story of the textbook, that it shows that little by little, here a little, there a little, step by step, we begin to embody more and more of the divine principle. Though we know that fundamentally we are the Son of God, that though we know that fundamentally the true man embodies whole and has the right to embody the whole. You see, just to illustrate what I meant to say, if we take from the chapter on prayer first few subjects which put forward the proposition that in order to approach God, we must be willing to seek the seeking of God as it is. Second, that there must be a gratitude for God as he is. A gratitude, as he says, for life, truth, and love. Now, for the third subject, that it shows that there must be sincerity, prayer of sincerity. And that without this sincerity, there is no sense of reformation possible. And in the fourth subject, there is a sense of honesty to live up to what we already know. Now, if we take only these four qualities, and if we would consider them as a personal teaching or preaching, which was said, well, you know, if you want to get anywhere, you have to see well, and you have to be great, and you have to be sincere, you have to be honest. Well, that would give an impression that the one who teaches is that already to the extreme extent, and that this is something which somebody has and the other may not have. But that is not science. See, when we approach the textbook and investigate together a text, this text, then we may find so many points like seeking, gratitude, sincerity, honesty, which to a great extent each one of us has experienced and manifested, and where we could say, well, I know that, that's quite natural, that this is necessary, or where one could say, well, I have lived up to that point to a certain extent, but that would be all religious teaching and a religious concept of the textbook. The scientific mind is much more interested in perceiving the science of the prayer and is asking oneself, now, what is anyway and in every case necessary in order to approach God scientifically? That is the question. And in asking oneself that question, and then coming to the conclusion through the text that only the seeking attitude brings us near to God, that only the attitude of gratitude for what already is, for the being that is, brings us near to God, that only that attitude of sincerity and willingness change brings us near to God, that only the attitude of honesty brings us near to God, begins to show, you see, this investigation begins to show that these are not just some wonderful religious propositions, but that they constitute the fundamental scientific element of the Word of the Word. Therefore, they are much bigger in their consequences for us than just to be religious rules, because they tell us now that whoever wants to approach God as the subject of God, that to whomever we try to present the signs of God, that we must see that these qualities are nurtured, these qualities are cultured. So can you see what we will find and what is necessary to see? That we are investigating through the text those laws which are fundamentally true for everyone and are fundamentally necessary for the beginning, for everyone's search and research into being. Now, let us take prayer. Up to now, I have always recapitulated prayer in one or the other way, and perhaps thoughts may say, well, why recapitulate it again? Well, it is because we can never leave prayer behind. We can never say we have done prayer. We have done Atonement and Eucharist. We have done a chapter. We can never have done God. A chapter, like prayer, is one aspect of the infinite, and we can never have done an aspect of the infinite. The infinite is always the infinite and always stays with us and is always present with us, and we even want that the infinite is the all-present. And so we can never do away with any part of the fundamentals of being. So we can never leave prayer behind. Just as when we study the synonymous terms like mind and then go on to spirit, we cannot say, well, we have done mind, now I'm going to do spirit. Spirit always builds on what I have understood as mind. And so we can never really grasp the Atonement and Eucharist without prayer. And we'll see that we cannot grasp marriage without Atonement and Eucharist, which builds on prayer. So I go back to prayer, and I want to take today an aspect of prayer which we have never taken really. I once had put a question which was 60, but which we have never taken. Namely, the question, what is the mistaken sense of prayer which is uncovered through the chapter on prayer? And I think it's quite interesting once to take this aspect, because lately I have seen various people who have been so successful in presenting the textbook to newcomers, to absolute newcomers, by explaining to them in a few words the chapter on prayer. And they have done it mostly by pointing out the false sense of prayer which is uncovered through the right sense of prayer in this chapter. So let's once take those seven subjects of prayer and look at them, what mistaken sense of prayer they correct. And we'll see that these seven mistaken sense of prayer are very deep rooted in our mentality. They are all theological aspects of prayer. You remember the first prayer which we had, the first subject showed us that prayer asks us to seek God as He is. And when we read those passages there and ask us what false sense of prayer is corrected, we see there that the false sense is corrected which says, well, that it is that prayer of ignorance which pleads God to be what He is, which asks God to be what He is. It's a false sense of seeking. It's asking God to be what He is. Asking God to be intelligent, to be a blessing to us, to be unchangeable, to be harmonious. Asking God to give us this and that, to flow, to give us benefaction, to do right. We ask Him to do right. We ask Him to come out of His slumbers and act. We ask Him to be what He is. See how wrong our theological prayer usually is. God is what He is, and the right sense of prayer is to seek Him the way He is. The false sense of prayer usually in us is that we ask Him to be all that which He already is. That's the wrong sense of prayer. Then let's go to the second subject. You remember in the second subject, the positive sense was how it is shown the prayer of gratitude for God as He is, the prayer of gratitude for the good already at hand. And she shows there that we are ungrateful to God if we are not grateful for life, truth, and love. Let me just read that. If we are ungrateful for life, truth, and love, and yet return thanks to God for all blessings, we are insincere and incur the sharp sense of our master pronouncement hypocrite. And she goes on showing that our sense of gratitude must be right, namely that we are only really grateful if inwardly we are grateful for the fact that God is what He is. But the theological sense in us has been educated to be grateful for all sorts of benefactions. Grateful that, and then you know what comes, that I have a house, that I have a good job, that I am in good health, that the cow gives milk, and that the hens lay eggs, and so on, you know, very well. And it's so lovely sometimes to see people, how they go through a whole list of dozens and dozens of benefactions for which they are grateful and give thanks. And I think it's something lovely about it. But we must see that it doesn't touch the reality of being. It's not touching God as He is, if I'm grateful for a hen and for the cow and for this and that material benefaction. We touch reality when we are grateful for the real, for the phenomena, for the noumenon. If our whole love and adoration and gratitude goes out to the fact that God is in His infinitude, and not just in some of its outcomes, some of its phenomena, some material benefactions.